saving money on your interior stains and finishes now at Menards. Provide exceptional color to your staining project with Minwax Color Series. It applies evenly and dries fast with just one coat. Get a quart of Minwax Color Series wood stain in over 240 colors. On sale now through April 12th. Visit our paint desk and let our helpful team get you everything you need for your stain project today. Save big money at
Menards. The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So a massive welcome, Paul.
Hello, Paul, and hello, everyone at home.
Yeah, well, it's been another enormous week. Sort of top off yesterday by a huge sell-off across lots of data provider stocks, media stocks, software stocks. And frankly, I haven't seen for quite some time, maybe at the worst of the pandemic, sort of like double-digit losses on a lot of these. You had RELX down about 15%. You had Sage even down 10%. And the marketing boys equally got absolutely mullered, and we're talking really big companies, so this is billions of people have unfortunately lost large on perception. The trigger seems to have been last Friday, one of the very large language models, Anthropic, announced some new enterprise plugins or their software that allows big corporations to be able to do legal services better, marketing services, sales and accounting services. And everybody sort of like chewed on it for the weekend. And then it must have been a few big broker reports coming out from the likes of Goldman's or Merrill Lynch or people like that saying, actually, we've got a problem here, Houston. But so it took it all down yesterday. What's your view on the sort of like what's happened and the sort of like whether this is this noise or is this signal, i.e. we know what the facts are, i.e. there's a change, but is it basically something to really worry about, i.e. it's a signal, or is it something which is a bit more sort of like short term the noise?
Well, it's been fascinating, hasn't it? I mean, I was looking at my screen yesterday at lunchtime, I think it was. I do a double click on the percentage movers column, and I thought, what the hell's going on? You've got about a dozen FTSE 100 stocks. Some of these things, 30, 40 billion. You had Sage, Pearson, London Stock Exchange itself, RELX, Experian, Auto Trader, Rightmove. So you have the sort of semi-monopolistic marketplace shares as well, all plummeting 10 to 15%. So very, very unusual. I don't recall seeing such a widespread large move in FTSE 100 stocks outside of, you know, the day after the Brexit vote, for example, and outside of massive crises. This is pretty much large, you know, very, very unusual. So I mean, you I think really should take a bow here, Paul, because you've been warning people for quite a while now that it's not just that AI might disrupt lots of sectors in ways that we maybe don't fully understand. It may not. This is the thing. Nobody really knows for sure. But it's the fear of what AI might do that I think is driving a lot of these moves. And that's why I've kept away from all of these stocks. And you've also seen people chasing Roki. It's been a very crowded trade. High quality shares have re-rated, and you've got funds like the Nick Train of this world, for example, who are, I think, having to liquidate a lot of some of their positions, I believe, who, you know, basically look like geniuses for years, but were overpaying for things that re-rated from PEs of 10 up to PEs of 30, have awful balance sheets, most of those. Most of those have negative balance sheets with net debt. And we've been warning about these stocks, just saying they're not cheap and they're not growing particularly strongly. They're just, you know, going on acquisitions sprees funded by debt. So I think it's been a bit of an accident waiting to happen, really. And do you catch the bargains? I mean, Rightmove, one of my readers, likes Rightmove and Auto Trader, saying these are quality businesses now on PEs of 15. But you don't know if that moat is going to hold. That's the question.
Yeah, no, so you're
what do you think, Paul?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I would say for certain stocks and certain industries, it's definitely a signal that, you know, this is actually going to be structurally disrupted. And then for other areas, you've had sell-offs and it's actually more of a noise, i.e. it's a short-term impact. So I'll give you a few examples. I mean, if you look at sort of like the winners, I put into sort of like three buckets. I go for sort of like the enablers, which is basically your infrastructure boys, your NVIDIA chips, okay? These are the guys which have made making hay, we know that, and your cloud providers. And then you've got your enhancers, and these are what I would class as deeply embedded corporate software companies with niche or very large software, something like SAP or even Sage and Intuit. And these have been hit hard. And I would say those are enhancers, okay, of the AI, because that'll improve the productivity of businesses. And then the last bucket is the users. And I think the users, particularly in people like, you know, the medicine, and they're going to see benefits of the extra information. Now, more importantly, at the moment, is who's going to be the permanent losers. And I've put those into a number of buckets. And I'd go starting off with the research data information providers. And these guys, frankly, their business models are going to be almost replaced, or certainly a big chunk of it.
Gosh.
Because they haven't got priority data. Or if they have got priority data, it's not as good as the biggest encyclopedia in the world, which is the internet, and being able to work at sort of like, you know, nano speed technology. And these companies I would put into like things like YouGov, I wouldn't touch, Global Data. Yeah. Go Relex, I wouldn't go. Obviously, it's gone down a lot. Pearson, I wouldn't. Experian, and you've even seen companies like, you know, GB Group and Trustpilot. Again, information. I mean, I would say these ones are going to be seriously challenged. And I would say that's not noise. That is signal permanent. And then I'd go for also for the next bucket I'd put is advertising and media firms. And I've been saying this one for some time. People like Future. Cheap for a reason, because, you know, basically advertising is changing lock, stock and barrel with AI. And that's, and I'd include that WPP, Saatchi, Next15, even S4 Capital, all these kind of guys. I would be struggling to find whether they've got resilient business models under AI, because, you know, advertising is definitely fundamentally changing. And then the software companies that will be disrupted by AI, okay, are the ones which you've got doing applications which don't really add a bit of some productivity, but will replace by a plugin, you know, from one of these big large language models, or alternatively are fundamentally going to be replaced by AI. And I'd put Adobe as into that. You know, I'd go RWS. I know we've spoken to those guys, the translation boys. And I'd also, and I know we've talked about this one, and we think we both agree, Zoo Digital on media, you know, basically subs, dubbing and stuff like that. I mean, it's just going to get, it's going to get annihilated probably. I mean, I'm probably being hyperbolic here, okay, because of the timescales, but I'm trying to highlight, you know, these guys will have signal rather than noise. And the last one I would say, which is going to struggle, are those sectors. They might have very good software or technology in a particular sector, but if the sector is being disrupted, and I would say, and I've been saying this for some time, contact center software, I don't think that's going to be replaced, but the number of seats and number of people in a contact center is going to be hit, because it's going to be, you know, greater productivity. And I put that in bucket would be Gamma Communications, and I'd also put PCI Pal in that as well, because it solves anything that isn't a sector that is going to see fewer people in that particular area, i.e. selling. I think it's going to be tough. But the companies, coming back to the companies that have been sold off where there's opportunities, I would say it's people like Sage and Intuit and SAP. And I would say the reason for that is because they've got so embedded within those companies, and they've got the proprietary data of those companies. I think what they're going to have to do is, because they're sold on a per seat, on a per person basis, the licenses are the SaaS, they'll just have to change their pricing model to a value based or a consumption based. So where a person in accounts, there's accounts team of 20 and they've got 20 licenses and they reduce it down to 10, for instance, then essentially the SAP and Sage will sell that to, you're getting double value, and so the price goes up, and I think they'll be able to push that one through. But it's going to be fascinating, and that's my initial knee-jerk reaction to what's happened. But clearly investors have basically, you know, painted everyone with a broad brush, have basically, you know, said, you know, we'll sell, and everybody else, you know, have to prove their innocence afterwards. So it's right in my wheelhouse, and I'm very nervous actually that, you know, what's going to happen in perception going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it is tempting because the value investor in me is obviously sniffing around things, particularly future, you know, where you're only looking at a PE of about 4 for an incredibly cash generative business that I don't think has displayed any signs of stress from AI yet. And is AI all it's made out to be? You know, people are talking about it. You know, a lot of people are telling me it's not actually intelligent, and it can't do a lot of the things that people are claiming it can do. So it's just very, very difficult to work out what's going on here, isn't it? I mean, I haven't got the answers. I'm a bit skeptical about AI, but there again, you know, look at the effect it has on entire sectors. Just the fear of it is enough to make me want to avoid whole sectors, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think specifically with Future, okay, why I highlighted it is it is actually going to be disrupted, and the share price is telling you that. Two parts. First of all, its biggest profit and cash engine is GoCompare. It's a price comparison intermediary website that, frankly, you know, when you've got AI and you just say, I want this or I want some information on that, you don't need a price comparison website in the fullness of time. It may have another 4 or 5 years, but you don't need it because it's just going to do single shot for a lot of it. So that's the first part. And the second part is that its other big engine is selling, you know, basically it's got those technical magazines and it's got Marie Claire. And what it does on its online is basically do a top 10 best tellies that you can buy for Christmas. And it gets obviously the adverts and the click-throughs. Well, you don't need that either. So all I would say is, and again, I'm being hyperbolic and it is a bit black and white and isn't as clear as that, but that chart is saying that people are seriously worried that AI, because it's going to effectively cut out intermediaries. And in the intermediaries, I would say, you know, again, people like Rightmove, I mean, they're the most sticky and the difficult ones to get out, but Futures is an easy one because it's only an intermediary website. It's a portal, isn't it? It's a portal.
Yeah. I just don't know. It's... I mean, I've heard quite compelling arguments in both directions, actually. You know, some people are saying, well, why on earth would you go to AI to ask it about local properties? Well, I did actually to try it out. And all it basically did was, in just plain text, just gave bullet points within brackets, Rightmove, Rightmove, Rightmove. So it just provided links to Rightmove. So why would you bother with AI for property searching? You'd just go to Rightmove because that's the market leader. I don't see why anyone would switch property searching to AI when Rightmove does everything you want it to do, you know? So I think it could be more resilient than people think. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, I would just say if I was an estate agent and I'm paying £1,500 per month for Rightmove, the subscription, yeah? And I started putting my housing inventory freely available for the, you know, the click-throughs for the large language models. And they started then picking that up, which they will do, yeah? And then you start getting serious hits. We're talking, let's just cut, if you put the clock back 20 years, this is how Facebook started, okay? Because suddenly local people started realizing the response rates were fabulous, and that was the best place to actually advertise. That moment of truth, it hasn't happened yet, and Rightmove has definitely got the biggest economic moat because it's got all the market together. But as soon as basically people start breaking that sort of like, I can't go anywhere other than Rightmove sort of like philosophy and put it for freely available, then they won't need to pay £1,500 a month per estate agent.
They've tried it with Zoopla and with On the Market. You've got to list the properties somewhere. You know, you can't. So I don't know. We'll see. Yeah. I think Rightmove probably of all of them is the one I would consider dabbling in if it got down to a PE of 7 or 8 or something. Do you know what I mean? But it's just come down from a PE of 30 to a PE of 15. These are just very rough numbers. So it's not actually cheap, particularly if its business model is under serious threat, as you think it might be. And fascinating times. But I'm not delving in the bargain bucket just yet.
I think you're right.
Have you bought anything on the
No. I'm massive into software and technology, so I'm loaded in this one, and I'm quite worried about what if, you know, because it isn't clear. I sound clear, but I'm not 100% confident in terms of how it's actually going to shake out at all. So
I mean, things like your big one is Alico, isn't it? I mean, I can't see how AI would change anything for them.
No, it shouldn't. My biggest four stock holdings, okay, are all software. I've got ActiveOps is the largest. Just behind that is Alico. Then I've got Tribal and Eagle Eye. So they're all in there, but they're corporate and they're niche. So I think they're going to be out. I think they're going to be fine. However, if I was going to put my hand on my heart and say 100% they're going to be fine, I'd be lying because I'm not.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned PCI Pal earlier, and they do quite interesting stuff beyond just call centers. They do other things as well. And contact centers, I think they call them. They're going into the AI side of things as well. And, I mean, they put out a really good trading update. They've got ARR growth there. I think it was over 20%. So, you know, they deliver good news this week, I think it was, or last week.
Yeah, just for everybody, these guys do secure payments, the credit card hiding systems, which go into call centers. Yeah, I know we chatted to James, didn't we, about 6 months, and we both came away thinking it's cheap, it's a good quality company, and this guy's absolutely on a mission. And I didn't buy it. I think you bought some, didn't you?
I did. I've followed the share for years, and it's always disappointed in that they always crank up the overheads just when they're on the cusp of going profitable. They do more advertising spend, overhead spend. And I remember we challenged him quite hard on that, didn't we? And he just said to us, look, we know that we can, if we spend £1 million on marketing this thing, we can drive the ARR growth much, much quicker. So what do you want us to do? You know, to hold back on expansion spending or to deliver the best growth for you, the shareholders, because private buyer will value this company on a multiple of ARR. And we thought, he's got a point, hasn't he, really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I liked it because it does seem to be one of the best. I think it is actually probably the best software in this space, actually. I think it's certainly growing the fastest. I've just got this problem with contact centers. I know his argument was that even if they replace them with bots, you know, people with bots, then they'll still have to do transactions. That's fine, but I just don't like contact centers. I think the life of a contact center, the amount of transactions going through those is going to be lower going forward. Just because of AI, that's just my view.
A massive market, though, isn't it? I mean, even if the market shrinks 20% or something, you've still got a lot to go for.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Let's go for some M&A. Even in the software sector, actually, we've got Keith. He's asking about Pinewood Technologies. This is a spin out of Pendragon. It's a car dealership software company. Got all its credentials in the UK, but has signed an agreement with Lithia to expand into the US, and there's also one other distributors out in Japan, I think, and in Europe. So it was doing pretty well. Anyway, the M&A bit, it's got a bid from private equity Apax for 500p. So is this one going through?
Well, who knows? I mean, I think it's recommended, wasn't it, by management, who will have spoken to the fund managers, you imagine. So it looks to me as if it might go through, actually. I mean, it's such a nice company. This was totally the jewel in the crown, really, that was hidden within Pendragon for years. But it's turned out to be, the best bit of the business. And now that it's been sort of unshackled and it can sell into... I mean, it's a fabulous growth story, but how on earth do you value it? This is the problem. I mean, I was looking at it after, you know, it dropped down to about £3 or £3.50, I think. Yeah, you got it there on the chart, haven't you? I was sort of sniffing around it and thinking, I should be buying after the shares have fallen so much from that high at £5.50. But I couldn't get anywhere near the valuation at £3.50, let alone £5 that the bidders come in at. So they're really offering top whack for this. But it's growth, isn't it? When you have stellar growth and a huge market opportunity, people, private equity, really pay up for these things. So, I mean, look, there's 26p in it still, isn't there? So that's the market saying, not really, not convinced that the bid's going to go through at £5, but that might be quite an interesting little trade, actually, just to try and skim off 5% from it. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think it'll go through?
I'm pretty sure one of the biggest sort of like shareholders here, Harwood Capital, because when I interviewed Christopher and Nick Mills, okay, this was one of the top two stocks that I took away from that discussion and thought, right, okay, like you, at £3.50, it's definitely worth a look at. But I struggle with the valuation at £5. It still equates to forward sales of 8.5. You know, sort of EV sales. So you're right. It's definitely in rarefied territory. Now, coming to the actual bid, I think, yes, it will go through. However, my only now concern is what happened yesterday on the markets with software, because multiples of software companies have all come down after they put the £5 bid, and they haven't put a document together. So let's just say Apax then say, basically, well, given all the uncertainties, we're going to drop it by 50p, okay?
Oh, that's a good point.
Because the multiples now come down, okay? And you still get a healthy premium on the back of it, but your valuation has come down because everybody else's has come down. How will shareholders and the board react to it? And I think Christopher Mills would still take 450 because he wants exit and he wants cash. Whether the board would accept it is another kettle of fish. But I would have said it's a slam dunk. It's going to happen before yesterday. But now that there is uncertainty in the software sector, there's a question mark over it, I think, before they put their offer document, which is, I think, due by the end of February.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, here we are. 26th of February is the put up and shut up deadline, isn't it? So, yeah, that'll be an interesting one. And, of course, people can sell in the market, can't they? If you want to lock in the bulk of the offer price, you can freely trade the shares if you want to. So, yeah, be interesting to see. I mean, Apax is a huge outfit, isn't it? One of the biggest private equity firms globally, I think. Would they sort of undercut on a bid?
Oh yeah. If they could get an opportunity, crikey, these guys are tough as nails. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I think that's a yes.
Okay, let's move to another one in the M&A. We've got Claire. She's asking about Auction Technology Group, and I know we've talked about this, so I only need to do a bit, but it looks as though the largest shareholder and the bidder, Fitzwalter Capital, 21% they own, has walked away at £4 because the board basically refused to open the doors to allow them to do due diligence. What was your take on it?
Well, as you know, I took a bit of a punt on this on the basis that if the bid went risk reward, I thought it was pretty good. Around my average price was about £3.15, I think. So I just thought, look, £4 upside potential. And we've had, you know, that for me, as much as anything, validates what this company is actually worth. Because somebody was aggressively trying to buy the whole thing at £4 a share, which is great, you know. But then I thought, well, the market's telling us that the bid's not likely to happen, so it's probably going to fall through. I took the view my downside on that scenario was only 5 or 10%. And that's actually how it played out. So although I got it wrong about the bid happening, you know, I was lined up for what the various scenarios would be, and I found risk reward actually quite good. And it's put out inline trading updates. It is degearing now, which was part of the problem. So I'm happy to hold it medium term at around £2.83-ish. I think that's pretty copper bottom because we know it's worth £4 plus. Mm. So I think it's quite attractive, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing I would say is that, again, given what happened yesterday, remember, they are effectively a portal, an intermediary. And I like the auction of curated products, the antiques and the industrial machinery, which was their original business. I don't like their acquisition, their Chairish, which is basically just an online retailer of antiques, because that seems very vulnerable to a AI and having that intermediary side taken up. So I think yesterday, you know, it puts their, again, I'm not sure whether this is noise or signal, but I'd put signal on their Chairish acquisition and noise on their existing business, because I think it's got some sort of, you know, defensible moat with proper curated products. But it is cheap. There's no doubt about it.
what you hope on a remarkably low PE for the type of business, you have got a quite a nasty geared balance sheet with too much debt on. Mm. And I think, you know, having just about kept their jobs, hopefully management will give some serious thought to capital allocation and strategy, because, I mean, you can see the share price, and it's even worse if you zoom out, much, much worse, I think, over the longer term. They've really destroyed a lot of shareholder value. And I'm quite surprised that the shareholders stood by this management team, actually, who have, you know, turned out a dismal performance. There's no way, no getting away from it. So hopefully they'll, you know, take a hard look at their strategy and their own performance, because Fitzwalter was highly critical in what was basically a hostile bid approach, you know, really tearing a strip off them, which was very entertaining. It was very enjoyable to watch the public slanging match. But it's difficult to disagree with Fitzwalter when you look at what the shares have done and the Duff Acquisitions management have done, because people always say, "Oh, it's a goodwill write-off. It's a non-cash thing." Well, it was cash a while ago that they squandered on these acquisitions, and then realised that actually they weren't worth what they paid. And so goodwill write-off is just deferred cash destruction, I think. So but I'm happy to hold it now. I think it's reached a level where I think risk reward for me is actually quite attractive. So this is now in my short-term trades that have gone wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I would say on the
long-term hold.
on the positive side, I'm pretty sure when it comes to the next AGM or even an EGM, Fitzwalter are going to vote against the board, okay? They're going to wipe them out. And so consequently, we're going to get a new board in, and with the fresh set of eyes, and with a bit of luck, that'll improve the fortunes. That's the positive side. The slightly negative side, we have seen this type of movie before where a large shareholder's had a go at a company, been sort of rejected by the board, and then effectively buys the company at a lot lower level. And although it's a different industry and it got nightmare scenarios, but it reminds me a bit of Wood Group and Sidara. Wood Group rejected a 215 bid, selling.
Well, I don't think you can compare it with that, Paul, because they were absolutely on a knife edge. You know, that would have gone into administration. So, you know, at least with Auction Technology, they're de-gearing now and they're not in financial trouble. So, I think it could be okay, but it's a bit like Treat, isn't it, in a way? That was looking tempting around £2 again, I must say. It seems to have found a level there. I'm quite tempted to have to pick up a little position in that one as well.
Yeah, okay, well, maybe. Okay, we've got Tony's asking about Beazley and Zurich. I think they had an agreed bid, or just an agreed bid today. Shares are up 8%, best performer. Beazley, Lloyd's insurer. Zurich, the massive, great big insurer. Want to get into cyber insurance and speciality insurance, which is what Beazley gives them. Looks as though they're paying top dollar of, it's about £8 billion, I think. Was it £13.35?
Yeah, I mean, that was this morning, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I overslept this morning because one of my friends very annoyingly had a birthday on a Tuesday, which was most inconsiderate. yes, it's not one I follow, but, I mean, look at the chart. That's a nice chunky premium, isn't it, that Zurich are paying? So well done to holders, but I don't tend to invest in the insurance sector or life assurance either.
Yeah. I think this one's going through that. I mean, basically, they've been stalking them for over a year. They put a bid of about £13.15 last year. Well, I think it was June 2025. So this is like, okay, they want to get it through. So £13.35, it's going to happen, isn't it? You know, it's almost pretty certain. You'd be stunned if it doesn't. Yeah. Okay, we've got another one, final one. We've got Adam. He's asking about cab payments, the international payments, or effectively payment system for emerging markets and for difficult frontier sort of like markets. They largely lift and shift big chunks of foreign exchange to other people who then do micro financing for them. They got a bid from who was it, basically? I think their largest shareholder, actually, Helios Consortia, 45%.
Oh, that rings a bell. Helios, yes.
Helios, yeah.
I've never liked this share. I generally don't touch payments companies. I'm just suspicious to the whole of the whole sector, really. here we are, 2nd of February, so 2 days ago. Helios, that was it. Helios announced the bid independently to the market, didn't it? $1.15, which is 84p. And I think Cab P have rejected it, haven't they? Is that right?
Yes, they have. Yeah,
they've unusual thing saying it undervalues them. Yeah.
They're basically the board have unanimously concluded that the proposals are highly opportunistic and fundamentally undervalue cab payments.
Yeah, so they want to keep their jobs, obviously, don't they?
Well, it's pretty. I mean, no doubt about it. It's fairly cheap. I think I'd worked out the numbers. It's about 6 times EBITDA and about 13 times PE. But frankly, I don't think it actually owns the end customers for a lot of them. So it really acts as a bit of an intermediary, of shifting large amount of foreign exchange into these regions. So you've got to ask yourself, really, you know, basically, should it deserve a better premium than that? And given Helios have now got over, because they've got a letter of a comfort letter of about 5%, they've got over 50%. I mean, I would say the board, you know, reject this at your peril.
Yeah, this is the one I think that moves Forex in difficult countries, yes, doesn't it? Where you've got dollar restrictions like African countries and whatnot, which to me always made me feel a bit uncomfortable. So it's not a share that I would want to hold. You look at the long-term chart, and I mean, it peaked around £3.40, didn't it? So 84p is certainly not a generous offer.
Okay, good. Okay, let's go to financial services or lending. We've got Funding Circle. We chatted to their CFO, Tony, didn't we, last week? These guys basically have got three parts of their business. They've got a term loan division, which places institutional money into small, medium-sized companies, private businesses into the UK, which is their bread and butter. And then it's got an expanding sort of like revolving credit facility, short-term lending, which is on their own balance sheet called FlexiPay, that's going like a train. And then they've started, the third party is starting to add on different financial services products like credit cards to those particular corporates. But the shares have done remarkably well from their lows around, 20, 25p 18 months ago. They're now sort of 160. What was your take on our discussions?
Oh, it was a brilliant call, wasn't it? Fascinating. Tony was the guy who led it, and then Abby was on the call as well. Really informative. I haven't looked at a Funding Circle for a couple of years. I did catch a bit of that big multi-bagging move up where it was insanely cheap when it was about 30p, wasn't it? I think it might have even been entirely cash-backed at that point. Yeah, here we are. At the low, it was 26p. They had 200 million in cash, and the market cap was 100 million. So it was an absolute gift for the people who, because the reason it got that cheap was because they had all these massively cash burning activities in Europe and America, I think, which they then binned, didn't they? They binned off the cash burning stuff. And suddenly there was this whacking great pile of money there that they were no longer burning. And some shrewd investors really did tremendously well on that. And the latest trading update was excellent. It's just put out, 17 million PBT was expected, and they delivered 20 million. So nice beat there quite recently. It's an interesting business model, I think, isn't it? I think I was very impressed with the management and the briefing they gave us. I don't know how to value the shares. That is my main issue on this. We're being asked to value it as a sort of so-called platform, which means that you then disregard all the sort of conventional valuation metrics for an alternative lender. So I can't get to the current share price, I have to say, but it's certainly got momentum, hasn't it? For sure. It looks, I can understand people liking this share, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I tried to actually put some of the parts on it, okay? Because the logic being that the platform business there is the most valuable, which is their term loan, okay? So I put a 12 times EBITDA on that one. That's a lot less than the market would pay things like SoFi and Upstart in the States, okay? But 12 times EBITDA seems a pretty good sort of like figure to start. You get about 480 million sterling on the back of that. Then if you go for the flexi pay, if you go one times book, if you deduct, if you've got their lending book, and then you deduct the effectively the loans from Citibank, you get to about 40 million. They've got about 60 million of spare cash. They've got carried forward tax losses of 25. You've add all that together, you get 605 million market cap. You divide that by the share count, you get just over 200p per share. And that's based on a fairly low valuation for their term loan business, depending on how fast they can sort of like, you know, to grow that. So I think there's still a bit of juice in it. And it, I can understand why Richard Stavely's been and Cotney Rebel has been talking about this share for some time, because it's done very well for shareholders, hasn't it?
And the forecasts are really punchy. So if it achieves that 83% earnings per share growth, you know, people could well put it on a higher rating. But that's already priced in. That's my only fear with this. And they seem to be, you know, saying that they're underserved by the clients are underserved by the banks. All the credit has personal guarantees, and the investment, it's a really nice business model, because they're not actually lending the money. Funding Circle just arranges the loans, basically. And the credit risk is all taken by these institutions who seem to be falling over themselves to lend it money. So it's quite interesting, because that's very scalable, isn't it, that business model? There are no sort of funding constraints on it. And the worst case scenario, we questioned them quite hard on that. What would happen if a 2008 type scenario played back? And basically the loan books were just going to run off. Nothing's going to be withdrawn as such. You know, it wouldn't be a case of them going bust. They just basically have to scale their overheads back and, you know, and tread water for a while. So I think it's a good business model, this Funding Circle, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one part they do use their own balance sheet is that FlexiPay, which is their it's a higher interest rate product that customers pay. I think he said 25%, so it's not dissimilar to a credit card, and they take that largely on their balance sheet. I know it's part funded by Citibank, but that's just through their loan facility. So they do have a bit on their balance sheet, but you're exactly right. Most of their lending book, which is about, I don't know, it's about 2 billion, which is it's straight from the term loan, which comes from institutions, which is totally off their as I say, it was a fascinating discussion, and I certainly think it's a quality business, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I did flag, and I've been saying this in our discussions, but I said it to the company as well, that, you know, an insolvency practitioner told me that pretty much all of his watch list companies on his books are teetering on the brink, zombie type companies. They've all got Funding Circle loans, but you know, they factor in a 3 to 4% default rate, which is quite high, isn't it? Really, but that's. You know, baked into what's expected. You know, but it is subprime lending, effectively. Although people hate it when we use that phrase, but the high street banks seem to be not very keen to lend in this area, apparently. So there seems to be quite a big cake for them to go after. And, you know, often arranging the funding, actually getting the funding is the difficult bit. But they seem to have, they've got a long queue of institutions who want to give them money. But, you know, so it's the right way around, basically. They're awash with funding offers. So I think it looks good.
Well, they could get those institutions to give me a use of money. That'd be easy, wouldn't it? I'll solve that problem for them. I know. Yeah. Right, let's move to the consumer. I've got a real sort of puzzle for you to solve here. XP Factory, Gordon's asking about it. They came out with a profit warning this week, trading update or something. These are the guys which does escape hunts or escape rooms, and they also do boom battle bars. The escape rooms are doing pretty well. The boom battle bars have been a bit of a nightmare on experiential leisure. Anyway, they dropped their numbers. The shares went up.
It was absolutely bizarre. It almost broke the internet. I had all these people messaging me saying, Scotty, what the hell's going on? Yeah, I mean, it was a profit warning. There's no escaping it. I mean, it was a poor update. And instead of making a profit for the current financial year, they're going to actually now make a loss, which was obviously all buried and fluffed up with all the EBITDA talk. But, and it is cash generative, even on the old EBITDA basis. you know, if you take out expansion capex, it's a nice cash generative business. And my angle on it, the reason I hold this personally, is because I think it's a sitting duck for a takeover. And the experiential leisure sector, I think, is having problems, definitely. Overcapacity, lots of Me Too operators, and they're struggling. I think it has been a bit of a fad. To be fair, although the escape room side of the business is doing great, surprisingly, perhaps. But Boom Battle Bars, yes, it's struggling. So it's not the best business, but it's the sort of thing, say, Wetherspoons or Marston's or something could just buy it for peanuts, for loose change, bolt on a substantial amount of extra revenue, and absolutely nail the cost prices on all the drinks. Because, of course, the big brewers have amazingly deals with the big pubs groups pay so little for the drinks compared with independent operators. You could add millions to its bottom line instantly. So that's my angle on XP Factory. And yes, it dropped 20-odd%, which I thought, yeah, expected that. That's justified by the profit warning. And then by lunchtime, it was up 9%. Anyway, I'd done some sniffing around, Paul, and obviously I can't reveal my sources, but...
Oh, go on, tell us.
They're saying it was a reaction to the new chairman. The new chairman has been announced, and apparently he has a big fan club, if you like, a big following, because he's done great job at other companies. He's laser focused, as the phrase goes, on capital allocation and all this sort of thing. And they just, you know, the view is that a load of people piled in on the back of him announcing he was. The other thing is, of course, it might be somebody sniffing around for a takeover bid. We don't know. The chairman, apparently, the new chairman is highly, highly regarded, I'm told.
Yeah, it's James Vandenberg from Truefin. He's done a terrific job. So, yeah, I suspected it might have been something to do with him. We've got a top boy coming up onto to steer the ship. So, it's a good one. Okay, right at the other end of the spectrum on retail, we've got Grant. He's asking about Watches of Switzerland. Now, this is another puzzle, okay? If I was going to sell you really expensive watches, particularly when the gold price and silver price have gone through the roof, so they'll be more expensive and tariffs have gone up. So the price of a watch in the States is probably doubled in the past 12 months, but these guys, they're doing really well. They're selling tons of jewelry. What's happening again?
It's just bizarre, isn't it? Yeah, this share's doing really well. We think we like the company. We've been reporting positively. It's certainly, you know, you can see why panic sold off on the original Trump tariff thing. Then it bounced strongly, didn't it, up to £6, but it's come all the way back down again. So, well, and then it's gone back up again. So it's a bit of a yo-yo stock, isn't it, really? But we like the fundamentals on this. It's got a nice balance sheet. The earnings multiple is reasonable. I think it heavily relies on, is it Rolex, I think?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think there are question marks over, you know, how stable is that? You know, could it just be whipped away from them, for example? So I think there is an element of risk with this, but yeah, it seems to be doing really well. I mean, I wouldn't be interested in getting involved in it now. You know, I think the trade's been achieved, hasn't it, really? Maybe priced about right for the time being, I don't know.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things, isn't it, basically? It's like, isn't it, there's a principle, isn't there, or is a terminology for products or items that basically, if they increase their price, they become more desirable. And this seems to be the case with sort of watches. Is it Verbund or something like that? A product? I don't know. It's got an inverse elasticity, price elasticity, isn't it? And it does seem as though, because, I mean, I did look at Richemont and Swatch, and they've equally seen big increases in watch sales and prices, and they're doing fab. So, hey, I mean, you're like, it could just be that because they're selling to the ultra, ultra wealthy, and perhaps people who, you know, haven't got too great sales and want these really expensive watches on their wrists, then, you know, basically those people are not price sensitive. So the higher the price, the more exclusive it comes. I don't know. Bizarre.
Yeah, interesting. I think that Fevre or something, that rings a bell in my dim and distant memory from O-level economics. So I think hasn't Tom Cruise's Rolex been stolen? He's he's decided he's not going to live in his £35 million Mayfair mansion anymore because he thinks London isn't safe. Well, I mean, I think people parade. I mean, you know, you should be able to wear whatever what you like. But I personally have a £15.99 Casio, and nobody ever tries to mug me on when I'm on the 38 bus going into into the West End. So it's, I think it's just safest to have a cheapo one.
Yeah, well, in Birmingham, they'll nick your trainers, so they'll use them for tyres. Okay, right, at the other end of the retail space, we had a fascinating conversation with The Works, the CEO, Gavin Peck, yesterday. These guys, their USP, or modus operandi, is basically to sell products that get people off sort of like digital devices, smartphones, and encourage sort of like hobbies and crafting, knitting, embroidery, games, toys, books, reading, all that kind of stuff. And they came out with a bit of a shocker last week in terms of their half year wasn't very good. But do you want to fill us in about the turnaround plan and how he sees it? And because we were relatively upbeat going into it, we were downbeat, but upbeat by the time we were both upbeat.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is why I'm really enjoying these company meetings that you're setting up, Paul, because often they're with companies where I'm not particularly keen on the shares. So it's in which I'm not with The Works, because basically it's the type of thing that if it didn't exist, you wouldn't invent it. You know, and high street retailing is so difficult just to survive, let alone. I mean, I think they've done a brilliant job actually continuing to exist, really. And it's for highly seasonal, so the H1 loss doesn't really concern me. But the problem is your overall operating margin is negligible. You know, you've got something like in the ballpark of £300 million revenue, but it's only really making a 1, 2, 3% operating margin. And the problem with that is it doesn't take much of a movement in revenues or margins to wipe the profit out completely. And that's why it's on a PE of 5 or something, or even might even be less than that. And also the way the financial years are structured, the interim results always look awful. And then I think the CEO said something that stuck in my mind. He said, people didn't think we'd meet the H2 targets last year, and we did. And we think we'll meet them again this year. So he's just struck me as sounding quite quietly confident, actually, about the performance of the business. And they've got this target of trying to get, I think, the operating margin from 3% to 6%, which would obviously transform the numbers if they can achieve that. I'm a bit skeptical about whether they can actually. I think that was a 4 or 5 year aspiration, which I think looks a bit unlikely, but it's certainly cheap, but probably cheap for a reason. It's just a rather low quality business, I think, but as in, you know, low margin, low net margin. Net margin's all that matters. Gross, but he's got a lot of operational gearing. He's saying, look, we can do 62% gross margin. So if they can just get, you know, like-for-like sales up 3, 4, 5% or something, this thing would really motor. But I don't know how likely is that, Paul. What do you think?
Well, I came away in the same view as you to a certain extent, because I thought he was quite optimistic on the second half. And I was scratching my head going in because last year in the second half, they basically did 12 million EBITDA to get them to their targets simply because they had a really strong like-for-like sales, about 5%. And then they go into this, they start this second half this year at sort of 1%. And I was saying, you've got a discontinuity here. How can you do 12 million EBITDA in the second half when you're doing 1% compared to 5%? And then he gave us the answer, okay, because he's going to make 2%, 200 basis points on his product buying in the second half. Yeah. He's had an improving foreign exchange. He's also going to de-scope his online in the second half, which is loss-making. And I think he's got some other sort of like, sort of savings going on. And when you put all that together, he's pretty damn confident, even on the lower top-line growth. With the operating leverage, he's going to do your 12 million. So, yeah, I think they're probably going to get. If I was going to bet on it, I would say, given he's gone through Christmas, which is obviously his biggest time, you know, selling presents, books, and crafts, and this sort of stuff, he's probably pretty much in the bank because he hasn't got to do much until the end of March, because it always is it's a very slow time of year. So, I think he's probably hit. I think he's probably hit his 12 million second half EBITDA already, and he's going to go 0-0 for the next 2 months because everybody goes the first 2 months very slow. So, yeah, I was I was very pessimistic going in, but actually, I think the stock could do quite well. It wouldn't be something I would buy because of the competitive moat, as you're saying, long term. But if you wanted just as a trade or as a, I think you could see a bounce when they come out with their trading year end trading update in April.
Sorry. Did we lose a connection somewhere there? But I can hear you. Okay. Exactly. I think it's a potentially interesting trade. Not a share I'd want to hold as a sort of long term core position, really. And I think the trouble is that the everyone's in this stock for the same reason, aren't they? They all think, oh, it's dirt cheap. But it just stays cheap, and basically you've got a sort of revolving door on the shareholder register. Everyone wants something to happen and to get revalued upwards, but it's difficult to see what's going to actually make that happen. Mm. I don't think there are any divvies at the moment either, are there?
No, I don't think there are. No. But anyway,
like you say, though, it was a lot better than I expected. Mm. So yeah, quite good.
Good. We've got Brian. He's asking about one we've never talked about, which is Hardide, which is they basically do advanced sort of toughened coatings for industrial applications. I think going to aerospace and oil and gas, and probably a lot into defense. They use tungsten at the nano cap level, I believe, which they spray it on. Anyway, the shares have just been a rocket ship over the last 2 months. Mm. What's behind the sort of investor enthusiasm?
Oh, well, contract wins. I mean, this thing's been around since the dawn of time, it seems, Hardide has. Serial disappointer, always promising growth and never delivering it. So long term, it's been pretty lousy, which definitely taints my view of it, because I've followed it for 20 years and it's been hopeless. But the news flow currently is very good. they've got, I think, two major new clients. And the story is, my readers have been filling me in on the detail on this, actually, on my Substack. Some of them have researched it quite thoroughly. And they're saying, you know, once you're on the sort of specification, say for Airbus or Boeing or something like that, you could get years of good business out of this. So it's starting to look very interesting, I must admit. And the revised, it's basically broken into cash generation, and I think it's expanding a site in America, so which means it won't come up against the tariff problem, I think. Quite interesting developments at Hardide, I would say. I think revenue's due to double, roughly, from 4.5 to about 9 million, and that is it's profitable. I think the operating margin's about 40%, roughly. So starting to look interesting, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Have they got enough money, do you know, enough cash? Do you think they'll need to raise some more money?
I think they said they're going to fund some CapEx out of this latest contract. So it's tight. I don't think it's got any spare cash, but, I could imagine it certainly being able to raise money quite easily because the news flow has been so good. So if it has to dilute by 10%, say, to raise a couple of million quid, I wouldn't see that as a deal breaker personally. Definitely interesting. One to research in a bit more depth, I think.
Yeah, I was just looking at their EBIT margins. They're 18% or projected to be 18%. And you just look at it and think, well, this could be another Filtronic. I mean, I wouldn't want to say it is, but it smells a bit like that. You get onto these long sort of like term contracts and you've got high, what the gross margin is. Yeah, you're right. Gross margin's 57%. You get the huge operating leverage, don't you? But hey-ho.
Yeah, and very scalable, isn't it? I mean, you know, getting orders from aerospace, probably quite high value components, making the products last a lot longer because of this treatment of them. I'd want to know who else does it and what IP they've got. I think they do have some patents. My colleague Dave, he said that he looked into that. He said that I think they've got a patent over something to do with wind turbines. But given that the company's been listed 20 years, you know, some of the original IP is probably out of patent now, but maybe it's know-how. I haven't researched it at that level, but I think it certainly looks an interesting speculative one. But about 19 million market cap now, isn't it? So yeah, I think it's worth a look.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a request for anybody out there. Put anything into the chat box and about that company, because we've never talked about it before. It certainly looks fascinating. Let's keep stay into the industrial sector. We've got Mickey's asking about Trifast, which is actually a Harwood sort of favourite. I think Nick Mills is favourite last 2 years or last two times I've been speaking. These guys do sort of like masses of sort of fasteners that go into not into sort of like consumer products, but into industrial applications like cars, into planes, into other sort of in data centers and all this sort of stuff. They've been going through a turnaround for a long time. They brought new management in. We had a chat to their CEO, Ian Percival. We both were pretty impressed about what his plans were. What was your take on our discussions?
I can't remember the detail, but I remember coming away from it thinking, oh, actually, this is more interesting than I thought. I think it's coming back to me. This is the one where they do, unfortunately, have quite a heavy permanent sort of working capital position. And you really questioned him hard on that.
That's very politely put, that is, Paul.
You gave him a hard time, didn't you? But he took it well. Basically, they are a lot of the products. They're a bank for their customers, really. They're funding big inventories and receivables. And there's a limit to what they can do to actually reduce that working capital, because a lot of it is manufactured in the Far East and then spends 4 to 6 weeks on the water, tying up Trifast's capital. So, and it's a margin improvement story, isn't it, that Trifast? They reckon they can get their operating margin from 5% to at least 10% over a four-year period, which does make you wonder, well, if that was possible in the first place, why wasn't it done previously? You know, that's I think they just didn't have control over the individual operating companies. I think what they've really he basically said that the previous management expanded it, you know, bolted on revenue for the sake of revenue, and they didn't properly manage basically all these operating divisions, and they're now putting in place the basic nuts and bolts of actually running the business properly. All seem pretty basic to me, really, but I like it. I think there's an opportunity there. No, I don't think you're going to double, triple your money on it, but I wouldn't be surprised if you make 50% on this share.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, I think just a bit of detail, I think Ian, he basically said when he came into the CEO role, and I think the chairman did as well to turn around the business, it was basically 18 separate companies that had no operational sort of synergies whatsoever. So he basically has been setting about doing a sort of all singing, all dancing ERP system that he's been putting in and integrating all of them to get you maximize the, you know, what's fast moving stock, what's slow moving stock, and improving the margins, improving the pricing. And it's a much, much, much stronger business than it was sort of 2 years ago as the margins have. The last bit is to obviously squeeze more of the cash, get more cash out of the business from that working capital. They're about 2/3 distributor and about 1/3 they make their own products. As you rightly say, they get a lot of the actual distributed products, say from the, you know, basically from overseas. They do about 20% into smart infrastructure, which is going well. They got a hit from JLR in the automotive, which is obviously a tough spot. But I'm with you. You know, when you talk about sort of they're cheap and compared to their competitors, they trade about 12 times PE, and their competitors Fastenal is over 30 times, Bossard's on 16, and Bufab's on 28. So they're less than half ratings of what their rivals are. Mm-hmm. Definitely cheap in times of that sector. So you could see the stock doing well just on that set, if they do the turnaround. But I think with you, it's a bit of a ceiling to it. So I could certainly see a path to over £1 on this one. But yeah, regards to that competitive moat, it wouldn't be something I would go into just on the competitive moat. But I think the stock could do well, actually, could do pretty well.
Yeah, I think as the and this is the one I think where they've already demonstrated that they are making progress on the margins. Mm. So, but the market hasn't really reacted yet. So it could be a bit of a catch-up trade when, you know, maybe there are funds you know, responded to redemptions, who are sort of forced sellers. I don't know. I think it all seemed to, I mean, part of me says, well, it's not obviously not a very good business if it was so badly run, really, to be blunt. But on the other hand, if the things that need fixing are just the basics, then that should be fixable, shouldn't it? So that's your upside. So yeah, I think it's quite interesting. He said as well, I think, that the costs escalated during COVID, and they had no control over cost recovery. So it's just, I think, just basic management failings, really, over a group that expanded too fast and didn't really have control over these 18 subsidiaries, who, of course, all have a huge number of SKUs. So I think, was it 20 or 30,000 product lines they have or something?
I had 30,000. I wrote 30,000,
which we thought was absolutely crazy. Yeah, here we are, over 30,000 SKUs. He sort of sheepishly replied to your question on that. We both sort of, our jaws hit the ground. But as we discussed afterwards, if you've got 18 independent operating subsidiaries, that's only about, whatever, 1,500, 1,600 SKUs per business unit, and they're probably different products in each business unit. So maybe it's not, I think they're doing the basic stuff, aren't they? You know, like dropping the slow selling lines and focusing on bestsellers and all the basic things that you'd expect a good management team to do. So I like it. I think it's a credible turnaround.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, good. We've got Abel, your friend, he's asking about
Abel.
It's asking about building products company Alumask. Basically, they do sort of building products, they do roofing products, they do these great big storm water and rainwater systems as well. I think they came out with a trading update this week, which was in line. They trade at ridiculously cheap, 5.5x EBITDA, 8.5x PE. What was your take on it? Quick sort of thoughts on Alumask.
I like it a lot. It's one we've been positive on for a long time. Really nice quality business, actually. Makes a really good operating margin. I think they're targeting between 15 and 20% operating margin, which is huge for a building product. So they've got very good brand names, very much in-demand products, with premium products, which are highly regarded in the industry. The H1 results were poor, profit roughly halved, but they did a webinar yesterday. Management did a very, go watch the recording of it, because it was an excellent briefing on the company and its three divisions. Basically, they've got a very, very good, strong pipeline and order book. So I'm pretty confident, confident they're going to meet the full year numbers. And the shares are cheap. I think they're oversold. Lots to like with Alumask. Yeah, I've just remembered, actually, I'm meant to have published a section that one of my writers wrote last night, and I forgot about it. So I'll get that up on my Substack later today. So have you looked at it, Paul?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I know we chatted to the management team though. I think that the CEO, Paul Hooper, is leaving, and they've got a new CEO who'd be already announced, and they've got Simon Dre, the CFO there as well. I think they're a great management team doing a very good job. It's actually my top pick in the building products area. I've already got others like Michelmerce, and I've got Alico, which does the software side, but it makes good margins. It's got, you know, sort of good pricing power. Timlock business. Wow, is that fantastic in the roofing. I like it a lot. It's right up there for me to buy. I just haven't got any spare cash at the moment.
Same here. Yeah, I was hoping it would drop more on the H1 results, but it actually ended the day up. So
not that you're a cheapskate at all.
Yeah, well, we like buying keenly, don't we? I think it's just a buy and hold forever type of stock, actually. Very good quality business in terms of these margins are superb. And it's selling, you know, kit for airports and all sorts of big projects internationally. He basically said he gave an example of, the CEO gave the example of, I think they decided they wanted to go into Colombia. And he said, you just put a sales guy in the territory, go out to meet the potential customers, show them the products, and the orders start rolling in. You know, they're really in-demand products, which is what you want, isn't it?
Yeah, that's good. In the same sector, we've got a really good spot from a Lorenzo. He's saying, why has Keller shares increased? And I'll just put in the chart up, they've just rocketed over the past 5 months. I'll just any views why this one's going up? It's sort of going against the grain. I know they do most. These guys do piling largely in the US now. But
yeah, wow, it's groundwork, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. God, yeah, look at that chart. Isn't it amazing? Yeah, no, I mean, just from memory, I can remember we've looked at this a few times and it just keeps putting out really good numbers, basically. I don't know what the secret sauce is, but whatever they're doing, it's working fabulously well, isn't it?
The only thing I would say on a fundamental basis, it's not the UK driving it because all the building products firms are struggling. But in the US, with that big, beautiful tax bill, they're definitely putting a lot of infrastructure in. You've got new factories, you've got new sort of like, you know, data centers being put in, and they're calling for houses to be built and all this sort of stuff, and roads and, infrastructure regeneration. And I don't know whether that's the only fundamental reason. The other reason is some private equity guys having a look at it because it's only trading at 9x PE still, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, profits since the pandemic, looking at the multi-year P&Ls here, I mean, they've doubled profits in the last 5 years. Fantastic. Yeah, 200-odd million PBT it's making now. It's quite remarkable, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. We've got a question from Liam. He's asking about Fevara, which is the old... basically, it's the old cars milling business or cars group. These guys sold off their robotics and now left with a sort of like an animal feeds business. They do these sort of feed licks mostly that improve the sort of like performance and the fertility of cows largely. But there's also sheep and they do feeds and stuff like that. I know the Harwood boys are big into this one. I don't know if you've ever had a look at this one.
I can't remember. It's one of these things where we kind of look at it and go, a bit boring, really. It never really seems to go anywhere particularly. I think you spoke to management, didn't you?
I spoke to the CFO, Gavin Manson, about 3 weeks ago. And what basically their plan is to... Effectively, they're not a distributor. They are basically a cattle feeds product, okay? And they've got a number of strategies. First of all, is to go further up the value chain in terms of their products to get more margins. And he said to me, ideal over a long term, because they make sort of like 4-5% EBIT margins. Their ideal is to become an Impario over time and go further value and more functional foods. With the sort of the feed licks and stuff like that. That's one part of his strategy. It's a margin story. The next part of his strategy is to expand overseas. And they've just bought this really fascinating business in Brazil and the cattle population, which I knew Argentinian beef was pretty popular, but the Brazilian cattle is like 200 million cattle just in Brazil. And that compares to about 30 million in America. So there's an enormous market for his feed licks and his feed. So it could be a huge opening for him. And I think they're supposed to do, he mentioned that they're forecast to do about 7 or 8 million of EBITDA this year, but they've got very good line of sight to do 10 million pretty soon just on margin improvements and just restructuring and stuff. So, I mean, there's a lot of heavy lifting to do, but I was impressed about the medium and long-term strategy. Go further up the value chain, get more economic competitive moat, and then effectively monetize it through greater international expansion. And they have about 15% of the UK market for these type of food licks and feeds. And he's mentioned every percent he gets extra, he gets another £1 million down to his bottom line. So it's quite an interesting one. I was just looking at they're trading at roughly around about what is it on there? They've got cash on the balance sheet. Let's have a look.
Yeah,
what they're trading on. Is
this the one that did a big tender offer, or am I imagining that?
Yes, they did. Yeah, when they sold off their nuclear robotics business, that's what they did. Yeah, he did. Yeah, but okay. So the current margins are 6.5%, and they trade about 16x PE. But if they're aiming to get to 10% plus, so you can do the maths and you get to kind of sub 10 PE on the back of it. They're interesting anyway. If you like animal feeds, then think, sort of like what Impario's done, which has done very well. This is what they're trying to do. They're trying to copy what Impario have done.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, okay. Probably not for me, but good luck with that one.
Yeah. No, I would agree. Okay, let's jump into we've got Sandman. He's asking about which is better, Crichton's or Warpaint at the moment. Crichton's do basically cosmetics, but they do more contract supermarket cosmetics, whereas Warpaint do challenge your own brand sort of cosmetics. I don't know what they're both trading on, but I think they're both trading at pretty low valuations, actually.
Yeah, Crichton's has never really floated my boat. I've got to say, it's a slightly peculiar business. Warpaint, obviously, is a sort of former growth darling. That the trouble is that we're in a sort of information blackout with Warpaint. And when you get those long gaps, people sort of make up a narrative, don't they? Mm. And assume that the people are assuming, yeah, we've not had a trading update since September, I think, for Warpaint. So people are sort of imagining that it must be doing badly, and the Elf, this big competitor, Elf, I think it's called, is apparently sort of eating their lunch. So, yeah, I don't really have a view on Warpaint because we haven't got up-to-date information on it. So, they've left it far too long to update the market, I feel.
Yeah, they're trading, if you believe the numbers, I was just looking at the... what's they trading on?
Forward, 11 times.
Yeah, exactly. 11 times. Yeah. Mm. Which is you're right, for a growing business is definitely. I mean, I would say cosmetics area, it's pretty tough out there. If you're Crichton's and you're supplying the supermarkets, it's going to stay pretty damn competitive. But let's be clear about it. McBride's have had a stormer on the detergents and other soaps and stuff like that. So it isn't impossible to do very well out of, you know, and they do have some of their own brands as well, Crichton's. I think it's about a third of it. Warpaint would be the one I would go for if I had a choice. But I wouldn't go before their next trading update because I've got sneaky suspicion this is a challenged area at the moment.
Yeah, it feels like that, doesn't it? It feels like it might have another profit warning in it. I mean, historically, they've done very, very well. Owner-managed, of course, Warpaint. Quite low-priced products as well. So the client concentration was an issue that arose from when I did a webinar with an interview with the management a while ago. I think that was in September. And it turns out their biggest customer in Europe is they're very, very heavily reliant on that client. Mm. But apparently that's not unusual in the makeup space. But it is obviously a risk, isn't it? If that client decides to drop the products, you could have a nasty effect. But that's, you know, that's total speculation. I think people are speculating that maybe that's a risk because the shares are so weak. Yeah. And in an information vacuum, investors just make things up, don't they? This is the trouble. this is why they need to report more promptly, I think, more regularly.
It isn't just investors either. I'm pretty good at that as well. Just make things up. Okay. So my wife tells me. Okay, we've got Rebecca. She's asking about ME Group that does the washing machines and photo booths and stuff like that. I think the announcement this week was that the founder managers, was it Serge or something? His son is now taking over, or deputy CEO.
That was it. Yeah, that was it. I think Rebecca posted something about this on my Substack. It was, I think he's early to mid-80s, founder still running the business, who's handing it over to family. I think there was a secondary placing as well that hurt the share price. I mean, it looks so cheap, doesn't it? It's been a painful journey over the last year for shareholders in ME Group. It looks a very good quality business, I think, as far as I can tell. Question marks over the longevity of how long people will need photo booths for identity. There's different schools of thought on it. Some are that, well, if you take a picture on your iPhone, it could be doctored. So for government ID purposes, there'll always be a need for photo booths in some markets, some people are saying. And obviously the laundry, the laundrette business is very good at ME Group. That is growing very, very well, very profitable, self-funded growth, and you get nice divvies, I think. I mean, the numbers look lovely, don't they, for ME Group? Yeah. Very good value.
Yeah, I personally don't like nepotism, and I'm not disparaging the new guy coming in, his son, but I just that always looks as though it isn't the shareholders basically voting because the dad's the biggest shareholder. I just find it. I would want to speak to this deputy CEO before I got comfortable with that because it's a big, it's the biggest and the most important decision, you know, when it comes to running a business long term. The dad's done a fabulous job, and I'm sure the son will do an equally good job. But succession is always a bit of an issue with me if it just goes straight from
I'm probably more relaxed about that because I love these family controlled businesses. They tend to make such good long term decisions, you know, and they protect the equity from dilution much more than hired hands do. So unless there was some specific reason to think he wasn't suitable, then I don't have a problem with that personally. I mean, I can remember this stock over 20 years ago when it was about 10p. I remember people thinking the internet would kill its business. And of course, it hasn't at all. So, you know, but that's one of the reasons the shares are often cheap, because people are not convinced that the core business is sustainable long term. I don't really have a view on that personally.
No. Okay, good. We've got MSKMLS asking about Cordell, basically the rail track monitoring system. You got any quick thoughts on it? I know we've chatted about it quite a lot.
Didn't we cover that last week?
Yeah, they've come out with some tough times. I think a lot of their contracts have been deferred, haven't they, particularly in the States and the US?
Yeah. It's struggling to achieve scale, basically, isn't it? Yeah. It's interesting products, but like so many of these micro caps, you know, funding is quite often inadequate, and they just can't seem to land enough contracts to scale the business up. Probably I don't think I'll be buying that one again, unless it sort of wins some bigger contracts and gets some better visibility.
Good. We've got Richard Leppington. He's asking about Zote Foams, basically that the specialist foams business that go in for insoles into Nike and to industrial applications of cars and planes and stuff. He's thinking about buying some. What are your thoughts, guys?
Yeah, we like this one. We've been bullish on Zote Foams for a long time. Very nice business. The last set of results were excellent. It did caution a bit on the growth in the footwear side of the business, which had an exceptional year. So that's why the shares have been a little bit soft in the last few months. But we think it's very good, very nice. Niche business, makes good margins, strong balance sheet. Yeah, we're fans of Zote Foam. We like it.
Yeah, I would agree. Okay, then we've got This Is Random 4619. He's asking about, I've never covered this one, ASA International, which I think from his description is an emerging markets type. Is it a funder or something like that? Small micro payment?
It's micro loans, isn't it, in poor countries, often to women, I think, who need small loans to, for agricultural or you know, some sort of home-based business, that type of thing. I mean, the numbers look good on this. It's always going to be on a low PE, isn't it? Because you've got multiple high risk factors, really. I can see why people like it. The numbers do look impressive, but not really a sector I personally, and I don't think many people would want to invest in this. That's your problem. So it's probably cheap, and it will always be cheap, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's done very well, hasn't it? The shares have done well. It's got 220 million market cap, but you're right, at 5.5x PE, then I think people, you just say, they're just getting money out the country, sort of like corporate governance and all that kind of stuff. But hey, you can't complain with the numbers. I'm with you, actually. I mean, you know, tick your box on the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the low point seems to have been in November 2023, when it was 24 pence a share, and it's now £2.21. So people who held through that low or were buying at the lows have really cleaned up on this. So well done to holders.
Yeah. Okay, the biggest question of the week comes from two people. We've got Drew and John Tiller, and they're both asking about, where's your shirt, Paul? Your Zoom one.
He's got Zoom shirt. Yeah, no, that's in Bournemouth, I think, and I'm up in London. So, yes, I had to put in a substitute.
Okay, right. We've got final one. We've got Carl. He's asking about Bloomsbury, which is basically the – large, most two-thirds of the business is in consumer publishing of books, Harry Potter, Sarah J. Maas, which is going like a gold mine, going really like a train. And then the rest of it is basically the professional academic publishing business. And his question is, it's back down to year lows. Is this related to the software AI fall? And what do you think about Bloomsbury?
I think he's right. This, you don't know for sure, but I got the impression yesterday in particular when we had that sort of panic sell-off that this got caught up in that. I mean, if this was the one, we had a marvellous Zoom with the founder CEO, didn't we, last year?
And, Nigel Newton, wasn't it? Nigel Newton.
Yeah, it was one of the best company meetings that you've organised, actually. It was so interesting hearing him. He gave us a masterclass on the publishing industry, basically. And he used a phrase that about AI. He said the AI companies are beating a path to our door. He said they really want to license all of Bloomsbury's huge back catalogue of academic publishing works. He said that we don't get a lot of money for per book, but there are so many, I think tens of thousands of titles, that they're seeing AI as being something positive for the business. And he said that we survived the internet, we survived Kindle, you know, all these challenges, it's taken in its stride. So yeah, I really like Bloomsbury Publishing. I think it's a lovely company. And you've got lots of things lined up in a row now for good performance over the next year or two. The publishing, you know, the new releases for their best-selling authors are coming on stream again. I think there was a gap with the Sarah J. Maas books. And also, he told us that when the Harry Potter films come out, history shows that they give a huge boost to the book sales. So he was really, it sounded very optimistic, I thought.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think the two parts of the business are separate when it comes to AI disruption. In that consumer business, then it's basically this AI stuff is just noise because they've got those fantastic rock star, you know, fiction based authors, which are just going to carry on. And if anything, they're going to do better. So that's absolutely, you know, the sell off, if it was to do with that, is totally unjustified. However, the third of the business, which is quite high margin as well, that academic publishing, I think that is justified. I don't think that's noise. I think it's signal. And I think there's likes of, as I say, Relics and Pearsons and people where you're supplying, you know, sort of quite professional research, academic sort of stuff, then you've got at the margins, you've got to expect that it is going to get impacted to touch. Albeit, as you rightly point out, they are effectively monetizing some of that information to the large language ones. But the real engine, I mean, the consumer publishing business is worth far more than £5 on its own, in my view. So I think you're getting all of this academic publishing in there for free. So when it comes to sort of the sell-off, I still think it's undervalued. And if you get anything for, then you would get something for their publishing business. That's all extra on top.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's a real quality business. And I mean, you can buy them now at what, P of less than 12, 3.5% dividend yield. And you've got this, you know, fabulous long-term track record, owner managed with an owner manager who's still obviously deeply passionate about the business and the sector. Lovely share, I think. Just, I mean, again, it's probably not going to shoot the lights out, but just certainly the valuation metrics at the moment look really attractive, I think.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks everyone for your questions. Thanks again, Paul, for the shirt. It's absolutely fabulous. I've learned to shed load this session, certainly on all that AI stuff. So it's been really, really good. So
it's fascinating to see where it's going to go, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know. No.
Well, I mean, as I say, my portfolio is loaded into that. So I'm sort of like sweating, to say the least. So it's one of those things. But if you dance with the devil, you've got to sort of like suffer in it as well. So we'll wait and see. So anyway, same time, same place, same channel next week. So thanks again, guys. And speak
brilliant.
To
brilliant. Thanks, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.